I don't know.
I thought you started. All right, recording started, James. Start over and
say it word for word.
And, yeah. And bump your mic volume a little bit. It's pretty low.
Okay.
I do not know how to do that.
Hit the little carrot next to microphone, then go to audio settings, and then test speakers. And on mine, I have to turn off automatic volume for microphone and put the level all the way up.
It's all magic.
Don't flex with it.
Can you hear me better now?
Yes.
All right. Well, for real this time, welcome to the St. Louis Linux Users Group meeting for October the 22nd of 2020. We have a presentation here by the CIA LUG. It's a very special guest presentation. They are here to help explain WireGuard and the virtual private networks that you can have right in Linux. We have Andrew Denner here. He's the president of the Central Iowa Linux Users Group, and by day he is a senior software developer working in high performance computing and cloud computing. In his free time, he tinkers with Linux and plays the tuba.
All right, thank you. Let's see here if I can take back screen sharing here. We can start in on the presentation here. There we go. Hopefully everyone can see my screen here.
Yeah, looks good.
All right.
Looks like a screen.
So, welcome. They said, I'm Andrew Denner, and it is October the 22nd. A little bit about me. I'm a senior software developer at the company formerly known as Pioneer Seed. Now we're Corteva. And of course, this is completely my own stuff, not anything that they'd care about me talking about. So I'll be posting the slides here as soon as I slim them down. They're roughly 70, 80 megs. Unfortunately, apparently LaTeX did very bad things when it was generating the PDF, so I need to slim that down a bit before I upload them. But as soon as I do get them done, I'll send them out to your guys' list as well as post them on my personal site.
What's that?
It's a printing press.
Oh, okay.
I was trying to be clever.
It looks like some kind of motorcycle, I thought.
Yeah, it looks a little better when it's not faded out. I put about a 50% transparency on it just to make the text appear a little bit better. LaTeX tends to have a little bit heavy hand in how I ended up parsing this stuff. So to start out here before I dive into VPNs, let me just say hardware is hard. This was a presentation I gave a couple months ago up in Des Moines here, and unfortunately the machine that I developed it all on developed capacitor rot. I got a message on it that the fan had died. I can replace it. Ended up replacing out the fan, and the fan still wouldn't spin with the new one. Turns out right underneath there's a capacitor that's starting to get ready to lose its magic smoke. So unfortunately the machine is out of service. And of course it always happens at the worst time.
I
went out onto Woot about a week ago knowing that this presentation was coming up and ordered a new refurb. It arrives dead on arrival. So yeah, it also failed. So you know what, we're down to presenting on a Raspberry Pi here with a remote desktop because Zoom does not have a client for the Pi, and I really didn't feel like trying to chance forcing everything through the web browser and being able to still screen share. So, I mean, we were just about down to a typewriter before I got to that point, because that was my next option. So the show must go on, though, so let's go ahead and dive into what we're all really actually here to talk about. Networking is very important. We need the ability to access our files and local stuff, like being able to print to the printer or a local LAN drive, or, I mean, take your pick. And anymore, that could be from anywhere. Especially this year in 2020, everyone's working from home or away from the office, and you're not necessarily always working in a safe corporate environment with your nice firewall around you to make sure everything's safe. So really, what are my options? I mean, you can go out there and buy some service, but the big problem is there. Most of those are just white labeling all this free stuff anyway. So the first option I'm going to talk about is point-to-point tunneling protocol and why it's an absolutely terrible idea. Please don't use it. OpenVPN, up until about a year ago, I would have told you that is the option and you should go with it. IPsec, OpenSwan is the famous open source one, and last time I tried it, after about a couple days, I just gave up because it just was ugly and mean. And the new kid on the block, WireGuard. So point-to-point tunneling protocol. Back in ye old days of computing, in 95, it was a improvement on the PPP tunneling system, which was just truly point-to-point. Windows were the folks who initially came up with it. And it's just a plain old TCP connection on port 723. Everybody supports it. It's really stupid simple, and any idiot could really implement it. But that also means that it's completely insecure because the NSA pretty much, it's a known, not even all that secret that they've already cracked it and can listen to it and decrypt it. Which, I mean, it all depends on how what your level of risk is, but this one's bad. Basically, the authentication system is dead and cracked, and the encryption stream cipher is RC4, which is terrible. You don't want to use it. So, okay, what's my next option? IPsec. It has an RFC standard to it. It uses fixed ports, so it is really easy to block, especially like, say, if your network doesn't want you connecting out unmonitored or stuff like that. You can take your pick. Basically, it supports the kitchen sink of different crypto algorithms, everything from 3DES, which if you're using that and you don't have to, well, you're crazy, but sure, you can, all the way up to AES. And really haven't heard of Camilla, but sure, it supports it all. There are no known public vulnerabilities to it, but the whispers out there are that the NSA has an exploit that they can listen in. Again, it really just depends on what you're trying to sneak through your network, and really, if they want to listen that badly, rubber hose cryptography is still an issue. In theory, it's faster than OpenVPN, and the public version of it is OpenSwan, but it's fairly hard to implement, and you have to pretty much be black magic voodoo levels of knowing what you're doing. OpenVPN, it is one of the more popular ones out there just due to momentum. It doesn't have a standard around it, but it was developed by the OpenVPN Technologies group. It uses OpenSSL, so for better or for worse, if there's a problem in OpenSSL, there's a problem in OpenVPN. And it supports all of the stuff that OpenSSL can. There's no known major vulnerabilities, but one of the big concerns is there's a massive code base to it, so there could be stuff that just hasn't been seen and looked at yet. but it is really easy to use and configurable. You can set it on whatever port and whatever communication protocol you want, UDP, TCP. I don't know if it can do QUIC yet, but it, in theory, you could probably port it fairly easily. And the other big drawback is it runs in user space. There is no OS inclusion, but it's really easy to install and performance is not terrible. Now, the one that you're all here to hear about, WireGuard. It is really, really fast. It's built into the kernel now, in the latest kernel, and it uses a whole bunch of standardized stuff. I mean, there's more RFCs than you can shake a stick at. It uses ChaCha for the symmetric encryption, the good elliptic curve, the one that the NSA didn't salt with their special magic so that they could decrypt it better, and a whole bunch of other different stuff that's good out there. It uses UDP-based handshaking and key exchange, and it has some special sauce in there to stop you from doing replay attacks. And the good news is there are no known vulnerabilities, but since it is a new kid on the block, take that as you may, it has been third-party audited. And one of their claims to fame is that it's small enough that anybody can read it and understand it in theory, if you're an expert, I guess. And you can configure it to use whichever port you want, UDP by default. But because it is UDP, there is a chance that you can traffic shape it a lot more easily. In Linux, kernel 5.6 has in-tree support for it. And everyone else, as I'll show you in a few minutes here, it's rather easy to install the client. So no worries there. And like I said, one of the big benefits to it is it's simple, it's easy to use. The idea is that it's supposed to be as easy to use as SSH. And it's cryptographically sound. It uses the noise protocols, all of those other ones that I talked about, and it's been rather heavily peer reviewed, so you should be able to trust it. Since it does have such small code base, there's only a few lines of code, so it was easy to audit, and one person should be able to sit there and read it and say, yeah, this looks solid. Of course, now the risk of that is there are easy ways to screw up cryptography in ways that us mere mortals wouldn't think of being an issue, but it can be. It's also high performance. It relies on some really good primitives that are really nice and fast. The fact that it's in kernel means that there's nothing to get in the way. And it is really suitable for embedded devices, your toaster, that router back there in the corner, or even like a phone or a Raspberry Pi. And it's really well-defined. There's been a lot of academic work around it. Heck, there's even a 20-page LaTeX white paper that if you're having trouble sleeping tonight, I recommend reading it. It's profound in all the ways that LaTeX normally is. So the big question of how it works, like I said, the IP packets are transferred over UDP. And WireGuard is just a network interface, and it relies on your private key. And I'll show that in the demonstration here, but then you know the pure public keys that that's a public secret or a public knowledge, so you can post them on the web, wherever. And if you don't have both parts of that Trinity and you're authorized, nobody can listen in. Basically how you share those keys and how you share secrets around and all that stuff, well, that's out of scope for how it knows. It's just like SSH keys. How you get it there, if it's on a thumb drive or a avian carrier, it's your call. And one of the big things that they talk about in their documentation is crypto key routing. Basically, it's just a magic thing that says if you have the public key and the tunnel IP address right, it will allow network to go or traffic to go through the tunnel. Otherwise, it blocks it if the key isn't right. And each peer has the public key that they use to authenticate. And it's those are public, and it doesn't matter who you pass them around to. And one of the more interesting things is that it does support built-in roaming bidirectionally. So the server has no initial list of peers. So you can be a road warrior out there anywhere and connect from Starbucks or from the People's Republic of China. It doesn't care. You're going to run into the Great Red Firewall if you're in China, but that's beside the point. It's not the thing that will be stopping you. But also, apparently, while you're in a connection, I haven't actually tried it because changing my end point for the server is a little bit hard to do when I'm not able to move around networks very easily right now. If the server changes its IP address in the middle of a session, it informs the clients where it's going, and it just all magically happens, so it's fully bidirectional on both ends. And one of the other exciting stuff that I was reading about, but I haven't had a chance to actually try it out, it is built and ready for containerization in Docker. So you can send and receive packets really handily in the network. What happens is you create a WireGuard endpoint in the network, your default network space, and then you can move it into the namespace of your Docker image, and then the Docker image can only talk through that tunnel because it still retains the namespace that it was in. So that's one way that you can secure a Docker container down so that it only is able to talk through its secured tunnel. And they have some documentation on how to do that. So in our demo that I'm going to go through tonight, I'm going to show you how to install it. I have a video of when I installed it on Ubuntu. I'll quickly show you how to install the Windows 10 client and a little bit on an Android client. And then just to prove how easy it is in Mac, it's actually in the Mac store, so all you have to do is just like double click and it's all good. And then the WireGuard is server for the public server is out there in Linode right now. So it's all the way down in Texas. So we're going to get around a little bit here tonight. So the first demo is installing WireGuard on a Raspberry Pi. It's fairly easy. There's one gotcha to it, though. And they have a great how-to documentation here. Let's see here. Sorry about that. We fast forward here to where the presentation is. And of course, here we see the performance of a Raspberry Pi. Okay, there we go. So if we copy our address here and go to their documentation for Raspbian, and we'll just open a new tab here. And feel free to ask any questions. Since I'm on a different screen here, I'm definitely not seeing any sort of questions in the chat box here. But for what you need to worry about is, of course, here we're logged in as user Pi, and it already has sudo privs. So we've already run, if we just run apt update and apt upgrade just to make sure we're up to date. And while we're waiting for this to run, since it's a great performance, does anyone have any questions?
Andrew, can you make that text screen larger?
Yes. Maybe. Preference, here we go. There should be a way to get this to go bigger.
Maybe try Control Plus on a Xterm and Raspbian. I haven't. I don't use Xterm.
Oh, there we go. I was doing Control Equals instead, apparently.
There you go. Perfect.
Okay. So anyway, though, we already ran up at. So while that's loading here, basically, we already know that the UDP port is okay because I haven't. This is just a standard one. Also, if you're looking at a way to contribute, apparently they're looking for new screenshots. But and I'm sure they'll happily accept a pull request. This is, after all, Hacktober. But for some weird reason, Raspbian does not trust the Debian package repositories. And I mean, why shouldn't we? So the first thing you really have to do is make sure that you add in the, I'll skip updating free type because that doesn't really matter for tonight. And Raspberry Pis have terrible throughput. So the first thing you're going to want to do is add in the key for the Debian servers. Which, since I've already added it in, that error message really doesn't matter much. Apparently, I just fail at copying. Now, the next part that you're going to want to do is edit your sources list to have the Debian.org unstable packages listed in there. And you want to pin the priority to behind your current Raspbian install. That way you don't end up getting packages unless they don't exist in the Raspbian repo. And then the next step is, after you run that again, you'll run apt update again. And then we're finally to the spot where we can install. So we just sudo install or apt-get WireGuard. We're assuming yes, because it's a good thing to assume. Somewhat sarcastically. And then it spits out a whole bunch of stuff that it's installed. Next up, you'll want to create your public and private key like I was hinting at. And let's just move into a different folder here. And this will just run the WireGuard gen key command. And you mask it to 077. Would help if I could type. Of course, demonstrations are always more fun when you're trying to type things. Oh, I know why it's warning me about that. I'm currently on an SD or a USB thumb drive. Let's try running that again from a actual real Linux file system there. Okay, so there we have our private key generated. And then next we'll want to drive the public key out of that private key. So basically you're just passing it in and then passing it back out to a key file. And let's go ahead and take a look at my private key because since for the purposes of this demonstration, I really don't care if you guys try and hack me because it's not going to be up that long. And there you can see that's my super secret private key that we're not supposed to let out to all the public. And then the next step that you need to worry about is creating your network device.
Hang on a second, Andrew.
Yeah.
That private key is a heck of a lot shorter than I'm used to. What is it, like 100 characters or something? You know, normally you're looking at a much longer private key.
Yeah, so the key passing algorithm that they're using is, let's see here, which one is it? I scroll up a little bit. So it's apparently using this HKDF format for deriving out keys, and it, apparently that's secure enough. They have a huge RFC explaining how they do it and how secure it is, and unfortunately, math is hard, so it apparently is good enough to seed it out, apparently.
It gets weird when they start talking about clock math.
Yeah, timey-wimey and all that stuff. Yeah. But the elliptical curves, I think, help also things enough. That wanders way, way deep into dark magic that I only like to dabble in.
This is why we pay theoretical mathematicians.
It's always been my stance that cryptography is hard and you should never roll your own. And that's part of the reason why I firmly believe in using other places where very smart people have already written their stuff for me. But so basically everything for WireGuard is run through this WireGuard conf file that's in your Etsy. So if we go to gvim, we can just go vim, the text is big here, and edit it. There, oh. Didn't ask, pretty please. Okay, one doesn't exist yet, so we're going to define it here. And it's really, this is a configuration for a server. And it's really just stupid simple here. If I can copy. Okay, center click isn't working. There we go. So we're going to want to grab our WireGuard private key that we had previously created. And you'll just want to sub in that. And this is the configuration for a server. So if you notice, there are no clients or peers listed here. So we are just going to paste here and save it out. And let's see, this is the rest of the file. They really didn't do a very good job of this. But basically, you're setting up what your interface is going to look like. So we're setting up a new network interface, WG0. And it's going to be a static IP address in the 10 block there. And you want to make sure that that's not the same IP address as your home network. Otherwise, very bad things end up happening and it gets weird. And otherwise, basically, it's just some fairly standardized stuff there. And then it's just as simple as starting it here. So if we go should be, well, I swear this was working before. If up.
That's why we always said never do a live demo.
Well, so the good news is
I just want to bring in, and I was going to tell you that I was watching you set that up, and for your private key, you didn't put the line in before. If you open back up your configuration file there,
yeah, let's go ahead and.
Yeah, on your private key, you've got the key there, but you don't have the.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that whole bottom part's supposed to go in Etsy network directory interface.
Ah, yes. Good catch. We'll get through this together here. I get in a weird spot here in Vim. And then let's go ahead and grab all of the networking stuff here that was supposed to go somewhere else. And copy it and delete it. Write it and save it, and now instead of putting it where we're, let's go to Etsy Network Interfaces. Interfaces.d. And this will be WG0.
I think that has a much better chance of working.
Okay, well, this is the point that we fall back over to the plan B, which is the pre-recorded, where I know it actually works. Give me a second to plug in the thumb drive with the file on it, because for some reason Raspberry Pi isn't playing, my instance of Pi isn't playing the video properly. But since we're in Windows here, we know that it will work, because why else do we pay lots of money to have Windows, right? So
because work forces us to have it.
Yes, that too. But so anyway, though, here we've we'll skip ahead a little bit here since we've already so we get through installing it and we set the UMask files and we gen a private key here. And if you see there, I'm copying now the same sort of config file that we had before. And editing my WireGuard conf file.
But now he's got a peer on it.
Yes, so this would be for editing for the client side. And since this is in Ubuntu, I have to allow a couple things in the firewall. I wanted to make sure to allow SSH as well as my UDP file or my UDP packets for WireGuard itself. And as you can see here, I'm showing that SSH is allowed and WireGuard is allowed. And one of the instructions that is really nice and easy to use is WG quick will bring WireGuard up. I think that's what we may have been forgetting was their documentation didn't really say to run WG quick. But here you can see that I've got the networking set up and it's ready to go. And when you bring it up, it's making the proper connections out. And then if you run the systemctl enable, you're telling it to basically on startup, turn it on. And the other big thing that I have there is the persistent keep alive. Make sure that it doesn't end up going quiet if you don't have any traffic going. And there you can see that the public key is right there. And I'll post this video out as well so you can go back through and follow along from home. Because in this case, the LI machine is the server out in the cloud, and Spock is this sad little old machine that's dead now. And here you can see that it is actually connected now. It has last handshake was 9 seconds ago, and there is traffic, and you can ping it, and everything's working. And go ahead.
How hard is it to set up your routes from the endpoint to the server to, you know, say if you want to route more than your IP across it?
So if you look over on the right side of the screen there, I have the IP table. You can sneak into your networking file IP table commands, and that will, you can set up whatever routing capabilities you want to set up. So if you speak IP tables, it's easy. If you don't, good luck.
Post up, post down. Post up, add the route after it comes up. Post down, take it out after you take it down.
That's correct. So the dash A is add the forwarding commands. and the dash D is delete them after they're done. And getting too much further into IP tables, I have to look it up because it's not really something that I normally mess with. There's a whole networking team at work that deals with that stuff, so I don't have to worry about it.
Yeah, it's a shame you couldn't get UFW to do it.
Yeah, so it should be interesting. The documentation for actually, I believe it, because the version of Linux that I was running this on didn't have UFW working well. So that was setting up the networking. The other really impressive thing here is for the Mac OS install. It's just so stupid. You search in the store for WireGuard and you click Git. And then you click install. And you watch it spin for a second. And that's it. And then you just have to import your tunnel file like what you had before. Or you can set it up from an empty tunnel. And basically you're just editing the text file here. Okay, so here's where I'm importing from file. Yep, and there's the same WGOconf that I had before. It asks if you'd like to add it, and then you just click activate. And as soon as that light turns green, you'll notice it has a little start, and as soon as the dragons show up there, like what you're expecting, you can see it's working. It's really stupid easy. And if we open up a terminal, you can see that you can run ping and hit the end server here. Or first I looked at ifconfig, and you can see the tunnel is set up there. And I have a couple other different VPN connections as well, but it just works. And then if you run...
Hang on a second. Which one of those is... I don't see any WGs in that list. That's the DRAM.
So it ended up naming it differently. It, if we rewind here a bit. Should be named. Well, let's see here. It ends up being, based on the IP address, it ends up being TUN2 there, UTUN2. Their naming is apparently a little bit weird, because I know that it goes from 10.200.02, so that should be the correct one there. It's really weird how that ended up getting labeled.
Yeah, it doesn't even error. Okay, I see it. You're looking at the IP there.
Yeah, and that's just knowing what IP address it was set up as. But then when I go to ping, you can see that it properly travels through the tunnel, and one of the hints is how long it took to get there. And apparently I didn't quite have network forwarding working on the host side there, so it right now it's a VPN connection only to one.
Yeah, like if you were working off site and you wanted to route all your traffic back through the VPN, then you'd have to set that for your default route, I guess, right?
Yeah, that would be your best route there. And the thing is, for Android here, it's, again, just about as easy as you're adding it for Mac. You just go ahead and import it, or you can also use a QR code that encodes everything. And then you just have to name it, and everything comes along just that simple. And here in a second, I'll show you how to generate that QR code. And yes, I know at the time I was recording this, number one, it's late at night, and number two, it was about the end of the day as far as the battery was concerned. But so to generate your QR code, it's really simple. You take your WGOconf file and you use a program called QR Encode, and you just install it via apt. And you have to set the formatting to ANSI UTF-8, and that's really all there is to it. It's fairly simple. I think that's about all the show and tell I had set up to show here. I mean, we do have a Linode box here that, if I grabbed the right machine here. Well, apparently we don't. Anyway, though, there. Oh, that's part of the reason why I was so confused, is the one tab I had open was actually a Linode machine, not a Raspberry Pi. Anyway, it helps when you actually label what tab you're in, because apparently Raspberry Pi isn't honoring the console there, so I was looking at the Pi at Raspberry in, instead of the root at Li 403. That explains so much. Anyway, though, that was what I had presentation wise scheduled for you guys.
Cool.
I can hit stop share, and then I'll hand it back to whoever is in charge of whatever's next for you guys here. If it goes to standard, just chew the rag, or just where we go from here.
This is Stan. When you send the PDF and that little video, send them to editor@slug.org, please.
Okay, I'll get that PDF resized as well, and because I doubt you want a 70 meg video or a 70 meg PDF coming your way.
Anybody have any questions? What are your questions?
And if there aren't any other questions, I can talk briefly on how the presentation itself was generated as well, if there's interest in that.
I would be interested in that.
Yeah. I'd go for that.
Okay, here, I'll jump back into screen sharing then. And so it's not hugely exciting here, but it is a LaTeX presentation using Beamer. So if we jump.
What platform is that?
This? This is, you mean the OS-wise?
Yes.
This is a Raspberry Pi running Raspberry OS. It used to be called Raspbian.
Oh, I didn't see the little Raspberry icon up there. It's kind of covered by the recording.
Yep. Thing. So the goofy thing I am doing is I have a remote desktop set up on this so that I'm sharing the remote desktop across from a Windows machine so that I can run Zoom. So if I go to presentations here, so the it's basically just a standard LaTeX file. We'll open up edit anyway, because sure, why not? And let's bring this up to full screen.
Bump the font a couple times, please.
Working on it here.
Control plus try.
Okay, there's another way to do this here. Spaces in devices is always fun. Okay, so here we are. Is that text big enough for you?
I'm okay.
Yes. Yes.
Okay, so if we read our and let's edit anyway. So this is just your standard, it's using a style file called Presento, which was just downloaded from, I think it was Overleaf or something like that. And then it's just your standard LaTeX document with title and then a little bit of fun command work for getting the pictures to show up in the slide right, your standard make a title slide, and then just your standard Beamer frame sort of stuff to have your slides work. And then to build it, it's fairly easy here. It was built using XE LaTeX. And just hit run and it runs. And generates up all the pages. And then the only problem is, since I have some fairly good sized pictures that I included in, the PDF file ends up being 76 megs in size. And since it's using the program XE LaTeX to generate all the stuff, it ends up embedding the fonts and all the images and stuff in there. The images are just a stack of JPEGs. So nothing overly profound or fancy, but it is kind of cool using LaTeX to do that. I can go ahead and drop that into a GitLab repo if someone wants template to be able to generate these sort of presentations, because it really is hard to find a good LaTeX generator that looks good. I mean, they all look like they were generated by LaTeX, usually. Which is great if you're going for a scientific presentation. A little less good if it's anything else.
So do you use WireGuard personally? Have you set up a VPN like in the US or outside the US?
So I haven't used it very heavily personally, just because since I'm not really traveling much due to the pandemic, there hasn't been much, oh, hey, I'm outside my network, I need to download files. If I make it as far as my mailbox in a day, I'm doing pretty good right now. And it really only became a major thing where it was in the kernel, and it was a big deal, like right when things started getting crazy. So I want to, I'm really excited to, but we're not quite there yet. I'm really interested in using it sort of a few months before this one, this presentation. Back when we were still in person, I gave a presentation on using a Raspberry Pi as a jump server, basically using Tor as the networking connection to get you in. And since then, I've moved and I'm on a different network. So I just exposing out an IP address and using WireGuard seems like a really great way of handling that instead. Because Tor is great if you want to be secure, but it's also absolutely terrible at performance-wise, just because there's so much latency there.
Yeah.
Not to mention the performance hits that you take in using a Raspberry Pi for doing anything.
Yeah. But it's the Raspberry Pi 4 is supposed to be better, right?
Yeah, the SD card is still your biggest enemy and bottleneck.
Yeah.
But supposedly, I had heard something the other night about how there's supposedly some sort of undocumented faster mode that they've found that shows promise in making your SD card go faster.
This is Stan. They've moved it into the kernel. Just what does that mean? I don't see the difference between this and...
The thing to think about is if a great example of kernel versus user level is your file system, most of your file systems on your Linux machine are running in the kernel. It's that ring zero, it's at the highest privilege, it has nothing between it and being able to do whatever it needs to do. Where user level, you're running as a user, you have only the user privileges, and you're limited to that. So any of your mount an NTFS drive or something like that, where you're using, the name of the system escapes me, but that Fuse file system is user level. In all practicality, there's a bit of a performance bump in decreasing the number of layers of privilege between you and the bare metal. But it is also somewhat of a risk because user level, if something escapes and you get pwned or something like that, well, they're still you. They're not running as the kernel itself. Where this, the WireGuard code is actually in the kernel itself, it's compiled in, it's there as a module.
Thank you. I almost understand that.
Yeah, the big thing to think about on that is that you're for user level stuff, you're kind of playing a game of telephone, where you as a user have to talk to someone who has to talk to someone, etc. And then eventually the commands run down there on the bare metal.
Comparing it with the Fuse or the SS FS, SSHFS kind of helps.
Yep. And I don't know if you've ever noticed, but performance on Fuse, they've done a lot of work. It's better than it once was, but it's still not native bare metal.
It works well for me.
It's good enough. They really have put a lot of work into it, and it's a lot less painful than it once was.
Yeah. It seems like to me in the last 18 months, it made a significant improvement. So.
It really has. I think the one true benefit to this entire pandemic year that we've all been stuck in is both video conferencing and just IT in general has gotten better just due to mother necessity requiring it. Now, everything else can just go stick its head in a bucket, but at least there's one good thing that's come out of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Over the long term, moving this security things into the kernel instead of being out in user space, so it seems like that would be a good thing from the standpoint that, when the U.S. Congress decides to outlaw encryption, or at least require backdoors, that maybe that would keep that from happening. But then I would be a criminal.
I was going to say, never discount the threat of rubber hose cryptography. Yeah. If people aren't familiar with that term, it's basically, there's an XKCD comic out there.
Yeah, that's the one where they got the in reality, they put you on drugs and hit you with a wrench.
Yeah, I'm pulling it up here. Let me get back to screen sharing here. His laptop's encrypted. Let's build a multi-million dollar cluster to crack it. No good. It's RSA 4096. Blast our evil plan as well. Well, let's just use a $5 wrench and hit him until he tells us the password.
Yeah.
Nation state security is really a hard thing to secure yourself from when they can just beat you till you give up your password. Also, the biggest thing is nobody actually really cares. I have a friend who works for Facebook, and one of the questions was, so you guys are monitoring everything we do, right? And his answer was, you're not that interesting.
We don't have that much storage space.
Yeah.
We have more important things to keep track of.
Cat pictures.
And I'm a cheap drunk, a beer and a half, and I'll tell you anything.
Well, thank you for having me, though, tonight, and hopefully that was useful and informative.
Yeah, very. Oh. Although I have to make one comment. Since you've been bad-mouthing Raspberry Pi 4s, let me show you what a Raspberry Pi 2 can do. This is here in the Batcave. It's actively tracking 63 airplanes within 200 miles of St. Louis. Putting up a UI as well as sharing data with FlightAware.
That is impressive. I need to get my little SDR back running again. I was decoding the digital police band here since locally they've switched over to the digital P25 encoding for their traffic.
Mm-hmm.
Which makes it a lot harder to be entertained on a Saturday night.
Yeah, I mean, and this is one of the presentations I might do here in upcoming months. It's actually the hardest part is mounting the antenna and running a decent coax down to the Pi.
That was my question. Was did you just have a rubber duck on there, or?
Oh no, I The antenna is a FlightAware antenna. I found mine on a peak of the roof. And I'll have to look it up, but I got low-loss coax, about half an inch in diameter. About a 15-foot run from there down to the utility box I got in the garage where I mounted the pie. Yeah, the only thing I'm missing is I couldn't find any of my heat sinks. And I changed the case. One of the cases I had was designed for tabletop mounting because it had air vents on the bottom and the top, flat. But since I was putting it in a cabinet, it's going to be mounted vertically. So I changed the case to one with air vents on the top where the heat can leave. And then I ordered some new heat sinks. You guys actually get a kit of three heat sinks for about $3, one for the CPU, one for the USB controller, and then one for the chip that's on the bottom side of the board under the CPU.
Yeah, and for all the bad mouthing I've given it, I have been really impressed at its performance. The only thing I've ever ended up bricking it and having to let it cool back down on was I did a presentation where the whole premise was that we were going to I just had a stack of different SD cards, and it was a desktop petting zoo. So each card had its own desktop display engine on it. So you had like KDE and Window Maker and et cetera. And unfortunately, it worked great testing it at home when it was plugged into a 1080 display. But the place that I was presenting at, I plugged it in and it was a 4K display.
Ooh.
And about halfway through it overheated. And that was with the heat sinks on it.
See y'all later.
See ya.
See ya.
And so that was a major hurt there. Speaking of the Raspberry Pi 2s, I do have the video gaming Raspberry Pi instance installed with a bunch of completely legal and totally 100% okay ROMs on it.
That's fine. The Chinese don't care about that, and they're the people listening in.
Yeah, it was basically, I think most every Nintendo NES ROM out there that ever was created on the thing. It does a great job, except for the N64. It just does not have a good renderer for. So if you try and play GoldenEye, it ends up being weird and people don't have faces, and then you end up falling off the world or something like that.
This is Stan. Before everybody starts dumping out of here, I'd like to show our planning schedule for the meetings we got coming up. And we can continue with other discussions if it's really appropriate. No planning. Oh, now I lost it. There it is. This is our...
Make it bigger, Stan.
I want to get down further, okay? What I can do. Yeah. Control plus. There we go.
There you go.
Okay. So here's the 22nd. Let's see. Need to update this.
Well, it looks like it was the September.
That was the wrong. That was, that was the old one. Here's the new one. Okay. Oh, here we go. This wire guard is today. Next week, the new lug will be up online. And we got a steering committee meeting coming up. The Slack meeting is up on the 5th. Base presentation is confirmed. Ed Holland is going to talk about using the Make It utility. The main is available. We're in the process of confirming with Tony Zafalopoulos about Open VAS upgrade. And there's some other ideas as a backup to that if he can't do that. And then, of course, during the further down the line, we're also confirming with Ken Johnson next month for this meeting on November 19th. He's going to be talking about Linux and MS Windows on the same computer. It's not necessarily totally about the Microsoft Linux on Windows version 2 stuff, but other things and that for a newcomer to understand about. And this is a database report from what we track at the steering committee. We have some ideas. And in December, base is available, but we're confirming with Scott Graneman. And we're going to say, Scott, you can do anything you want in 30 minutes. And if you don't have any ideas, here's a whole bunch of ideas of things that we would like somebody, anybody in this room could do one of these presentations for 30 minutes. And if you don't know anything about a particular area, I've even got a link to a site out there that had a whole article about that particular topic. So volunteers are welcome, especially for the basic level stuff that we try to do at the general meeting. And that's the kind of stuff I wanted to talk about. Any questions?
Anybody break anything this week?
So much hardware.
You and your hardware. Oh.
I broke my main system last week, and it took me 3 days to rebuild it, but I finally got it up.
That's the spirit.
Well, you know, I did something really stupid. I went into Gparted and started resizing the main partition.
Hey, I expanded my LVM today, first time without worry, so that was nice.
And it worked on the first try?
Worked on the first try.
Wow. I had an LVM with XFS for file system, and over about 5 years, it just got so corrupted, I had to throw it away. About 8 terabytes.
Oof.
I copied off the data, but the file system, you know, it couldn't be fixed. I'd run XFS repair, take it offline, run it for you know, 20 times in a row, and still had errors.
So that's the whole argument of cattle versus pets.
Is that a spinning drive?
Yeah.
Did you try spin right on it to see if that did any good?
It wasn't a drive problem. There was like three other partitions on that RAID array, and they were fine. And once I haven't taken it out. I'm in the process of swapping out the drives. I took 2 4-terabyte drives and made a volume group out of them, and put all the data over there temporarily. I'm in the process of replacing the other 6 drives with 4-terabyte drives. And then once I get the main partitions in, I'm going to create the data partition as a RAID 6 and say to hell with the LVM. Anyway, I got a question if anybody's interested. Go ahead.
I might have an answer.
Okay. Has anybody seen issues with LVM? I'm sorry, not with Let's Encrypt. Check this out.
Well, that looks familiar.
I know it. I just got one here.
Yeah, I got a couple more earlier. I'm getting them only on one machine too. I don't understand.
Well, I don't get them on this workstation because I can go to the certificate for that site. Where's the window with the certificate? Hell, I can't see it. Oh, wait a minute. It's not showing. I can go to the certificate for that site. There it is. And it shows fine. In a browser, it's fine. But for some stupid reason, when you're using the OwnCloud client, it throws up these random errors. Untrusted certificate. And apparently the organization is, where the heck did DNS filter come from?
Is it one of the intermediary trusted signings?
Good point. It might be. I wonder if there's a problem with the chain on this. Okay, maybe I'll log in tomorrow and refresh the key. Refresh the parent. All right, thanks. Anybody else break something this week?
Looking at your certificate just in the web browser here, walking the path of trusted signers and stuff like that, I'm not seeing anything going on there. Not sure what's the problem.
Yeah, it's almost like it's a hijacker or something.
Yeah, this just started a few days ago.
And it did renew last week.
It did or did not?
It renewed on the 14th.
You know, before that renewal, it worked for years.
Well, it renews every 90 days.
Yeah. Something happened on that last renewal. It has to have been, because it just ran flawlessly before that for several years.
Yeah. Well, maybe I'll just go in and regenerate it. All right, anybody else?
Well, that's about it.
Okay, I shall stop the recording.
Has anyone messed around with calendar?
What kind of calendar? Google Calendar?
No, calendar.
Oh, the actual little program that the GNOME people use?
I don't think it's GNOME. Let me show you what I've found. If Vivaldi would close, and let's go to a different. So,
The old text-based calendar. Yeah, I used to use it like crazy. Yeah, what's the issue?
Well, I can't go and change. You know how it has two entries for the first day of Advent, depending on when Christmas is. I can't go and remove the second one, the wrong one for this year.
It's been a long time since I've used it, but it was just a text file that I would edit. So unless you add the external reference things, I forgot how to do that. It's been so long since I've used it. But I used to love using the doggone thing, though.
Yeah, so it uses the C preprocessor to go and include them.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
That's supposed to also be clever at the same time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm really surprised that Arch doesn't have it in its repositories by default. You have to go to the AUR for it.
Really?
Well, it's so old. Is it still being maintained by anybody? Or does anybody care?
It's in the Debian repo, it looks like. And if it's so basic, it doesn't need to be maintained.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
It's like Kausei. How can you break it?
Yeah. I think I probably just wasn't using the right commenting notation.
If you're editing it with VI, right? Or Vim?
Yeah, Vim.
Make sure you do a set list to see if you got any funky characters in there. That would be a problem.
Oh, yeah. You got to check for the tabs.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes tabs are an issue. Sometimes spaces are an issue. Sometimes that when the moon is full, it's an issue.
Amen to that.
Yeah. Oh, I used to love using the calendar. But I found that the Google Calendar is so easy to use graphically to move, especially to move dates, events around on a day. You just click and drag them. Of course, the real problem is every time you turn around, they're changing what kind of input you can use when you go to edit an entry. It's really funky right now. The doggone thing will save something and it'll pick up three spaces between paragraphs. It's screwy. It's ugly. I don't know. And it used to be able, I could just use a simple text file and just copy it, cut and paste it right into it, and with no problem. But it won't take that correctly anymore. You know, it's one of those deals where they got somebody with nothing better to do but go in and screw everything up.
Yeah, I heard a conspiracy theory is that Google doesn't actually hire developers to develop new products. They hire them to make sure their competition can't develop new products.
There you go.
There is some truth to that.
Or they turn it over to an intern because nobody else cares.
There's no money to be made in calendars.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
hey, guys, anybody else?
So if there is some interest in some of those, like, intro Hello World level presentation sort of stuff, I mean, if you need a guest presenter at some point, you feel free to hit me up if you need, like, how to use CAT in 30 minutes or whatever.
you can stretch it out that long?
It would be a stretch.
Well, you may have noticed I put, like, three or four things together and how they're used, cut and paste and, things like that. Work together.
I mean, come on. You just have to talk about CAT as the perfect editor.
Well, you could.
CAT is.
Yeah, well, I've always.
Yeah, it's CAT 1. Yeah. It's less bloat than Ed.
Yeah. That's how Phil types, he uses CAT as an editor. And so, because I asked him why, and he says, well, because I never make any mistakes. So.
Oh, it's great to just copy and paste something. You don't have to worry about tabs messing up or weird characters if you're just catting into a new file.
Yeah.
I guess if you never make a mistake, you don't have to be brave enough to make that statement.
You want to control plus and enlarge that a little bit, please, Andrew? If you can. There you go. Those Emacs guys, you know.
Modules for everything.
You betcha.
Yeah, it really is an operating system in search of a kernel.
Yeah.
It's an operating system that's only lacking a decent text editor.
Well, the acronym used to stand for Emacs and constantly swapping. 8 meg and constantly swapping is what it was. Way back in the day when people only had 2 meg, if they had that at all.
Yeah, RMS, that was really one of the only good things that RMS really ever did.
Emacs has been beyond my capability.
I used to use Emacs back in the days when you didn't have any memory or anything. It wasn't a GUI. It was all text.
Yeah.
And it runs. Yeah. It runs bloody fast.
My impression is if you really are heavy into programming, Emacs is the way to go compared to VI or Vim. I mean, every day I learn new things with Vim, so I imagine every day you'd learn something new about Emacs.
Oh, yeah. I've always found it to be rather heavy-handed.
Yeah, I've done a little digging, haven't found much. Like all the tutorials start with, here's what a frame is. It's around the area you edit, which I don't want to sit through five presentations on that. But what I want to figure out is how to use the Emacs Lisp to actually go and create modules or to fill out programs for me.
What, write Lisp? Hmm.
Yeah.
Well, there's about a gazillion examples.
Yeah, but I've got 20 other things I'm trying to do, too.
Well, some things just take a little tiny bit of work.
Wait, can you take effort? Oh.
My problem is I've been using it since 1989.
Well, yeah, that's the thing with Vi is, I mean, after a while, you have to, when you switch out of it to go back to a different editor, you have to go and trim all your colon W's.
Yeah, your muscle memory.
Yeah. Well, as my wrists get worse and worse, I find that I'm much better off using the keyboard than I am holding my hand on the mouse all the time.
Oh, yeah.
You get old and your wrist goes bad. Your turn will come.
So, Steve, when are you installing i3 then? That way you can control everything from the keyboard.
What's an i3?
It is a tiling window manager so that you can...
Oh, you demoed that one night, didn't you?
Yeah.
Emacs can do that.
You can just create new windows from your keyboard. It all looks nice like that. You can switch them between screens and resize them all from the keyboard. No need to touch a mouse.
You know, I hate to tell you this, but Emacs has had that for 30 years that I know.
Yeah, but then you have to do everything through the control key. Ugh.
Much more recently, macOS 7.6 allowed you to do almost everything from the keyboard.
Yeah, people are figuring out, oh, that was a good idea.
Yeah. I mean, well, the macOS, I think they've mostly forgotten about it. Mm-hmm. Except they do have things like mouse keys where you can move the pointer with the keyboard, but that's still mousing. It's really nowhere near as good as the straight from the keyboard stuff they used to do.
Mm-hmm. It's a little janky and slow. I've got a keyboard set up to do that.
There are still a lot of things you can do with the without the mouse, and there are shortcuts that nobody looks at that are very handy references, and then, okay, I don't know if you can apply shortcuts to things that are not originally on the menu.
Yeah, Windows has workspaces now, and oh, that is annoying to work with.
Do they really?
Yeah, so you can...
Do they work?
They work with quotation marks. Yeah, yeah. You can't create new ones from the keyboard. You can't move windows between workspaces with the keyboard. You have to open up that big old slow view. And you can't create new workspaces from the keyboard. It's just, you can switch between them and that's it.
Yeah, it's, I was just noticing here, it's got, I know Linux, or, well, I use LXDE window manager, but it, Yeah, you can move stuff from one window to the other. I don't know if you can. I guess you can do it from the keyboard. I don't know. I've never looked.
Probably.
I usually use the different workspaces or desktops, whatever you want to call them. I generally use that to keep stuff separated. You know?
Oh, yeah. Me too. But
so I don't really try to move between them much.
But when I get a Skype message, it yanks me all the way back to where I have that Skype window opened.
Does it?
Yeah. Same with WebEx. When someone starts presenting in WebEx, it thinks, oh, you need to see me. Grab your attention no matter what you were doing.
Yeah. And if you're typing, oops, where did those words go?
Oh, yeah. Now, opening up a WebEx line and trying to type a message at the same time is awful because it'll grab your keyboard and then go, oh, you pressed enter. That means you want me to call you on your soft phone. Let me do that and blare right into your ears.
Ugh.
WebEx is the one web conferencing software that really hasn't improved with the pandemic.
I mean, it was, I don't want to say decent beforehand, but it can really manage a lot of people. I've been on calls with 180 people, like in through browsers, in through their little desktop thing, calling in. So when we need it, we need it, and it performs then.
Zoom's webinar functionality is pretty nice as well, but it all depends on how many people you have in the meeting, I guess, on whether or not you want to be in webinar mode.
I just pulled up Emacs and I'm sitting here looking at it, and I just pulled up a vanilla version and, you know, went to the tutorial, show you how to move around, that kind of stuff. I got a big red message that says, this is to teach you how to move around with a standard, blah, 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 blah. And it says, you customized this. So it doesn't correspond to the tutorial anymore. We've installed colored notices wherever you've customized something, which is interesting. I never saw that before.
That is neat.
I'll tell you what, there's a bunch of deadly serious people writing this. And, oh, yeah. There's another red command.
Yeah,
you can reprogram anything in Emacs.
Yeah, I've installed Doom Emacs because Vim has ruined me with the keys. So if I'm going to do anything, it better have the Vim keys.
Well, you could I don't know whether it has a Vim mode or not.
There's two projects, or at least plugins, Doom Emacs and Evil Mode, that include the VI keys.
Yeah.
Emacs.
Somewhere, I don't know if anybody still even knows where it is, but there's a VT220 mode. I used to use that back in the 80s, or early 90s, you know, and that stuff's all still out there. They don't ever take anything out.
Yeah. Oh, here is a problem I've been having.
What's that? When,
so I use Alacrity as my terminal, and whenever I go and SSH into like my droplets or another virtual machine, it does not recognize the terminal, and so I can't backspace correctly until I export the terminal variable to, I think I use VT100. Anyone know of a way to fix that or prevent it?
No, I don't. I've gotten down to using basically Terminator or LX Terminal, which is part of Ubuntu somewhere. Mm-hmm. And I quit using the console from KDE. God, KDE is a freaking hog. But
yeah.
I quit using it when they went from version 3 dot whatever it was to 4 dot whatever it was, or maybe it was 4 to 5. Somebody correct me on that. they brought out the new version and it had at least one quarter of the features of the old one. You know, they brought it, let's just say it was not ready for prime time. To use a phrase from antediluvian television.
I've always still been a fan of Window Maker.
Yeah. Hey, 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 features of bloat. You don't need those.
Hey, I always liked the Win95 desktop environment.
Win95?
There was a desktop, a Linux desktop environment called Win95.
That looked like Windows 95.
Oh, yeah. But it had some really neat features in it. You could make an icon that would run a script file and all kinds of weird and wonderful magical things. Back in the day, it was really something to play with. And you could set it up so it looked like you were running Windows 95 at work.
Yeah. I mean, that's what you install when you get the scammer calling saying, oh, we need to hop on your computer to
get malware. Oh, yeah.
Malware.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that was one of the things I liked about the one version of KDE before they crapped on it. It's, you could make that thing look almost exactly like Windows if you wanted to. I've seen some people do that. You know, you running Windows? No, not exactly. Wait a minute. What did you do? You know, I don't know why you invest a lot of time in it, but I guess if you got, you know, people need to use it and they've been doing Windows forever, that might make
sense. If you were at work and you were supposed to be using Windows, you'd do that and then you'd drop into a terminal and get real work done in half the time.
Yeah. It still drives me crazy that there's no real strong command line on Windows. I mean, it has a rudimentary command line.
They're making PowerShell, and it's getting better.
PowerShell is rather powerful in the fact that you can leverage the entire .NET system as part of PowerShell.
Does it run Bash?
You can also do that, too.
Yeah, I can see the on PowerShell and print working directory.
What could possibly go wrong?
I don't know. When I need that on Windows, I just put Cygwin on. Yeah. I've used Cygwin since the late 80s or early 90s.
Honestly, WSL2 has been a great improvement for both performance and being able to Linuxify things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And when I try to, I don't know, to me, just the command line is so powerful.
Yeah. You know?
And I don't have to spend all my time looking for an icon and starting something. If I want to do something else, I just type it.
Yeah,
I'm there.
As far as I could tell, there's still no good way to schedule things with PowerShell. You have to open up the task programmer thing they have and go in and say, oh, here's a PowerShell script I want running at here. And it's still annoying.
Yeah. And Wendell, why did they get rid of all of the Windows command line commands?
Yeah.
Why did they do that? You know, I mean, they had a few. They worked. They didn't have a lot of them. But, and then they went and changed all of that.
I'd just settle for having scroll back on the keyboard. Having to use the freaking mouse to scroll up a screen is a pain in the butt. Yeah.
Well,
yeah, Wendell, I think the one thing I can say about those that look like Windows 10, just because you can doesn't mean that you should.
Yeah, no.
Everything that's possible to do is not a good idea.
I happen to see it on the Linux distrowatch.com. I was just scrolling through and happened to see it.
Yeah, you'll see those pop up every once in a while, and they don't usually tend to live for very long just because the kind of people that are going to use that OS also aren't the kind of people that know how to maintain it.
Right. But it, I was just messing with it. It comes with like a bunch of stuff like pre-install Zoom. And so, I mean, I really don't use it that much. I just did it to see if I can get it to work via Pixie Boot, but it ain't something I use all the time, though.
Taking a look at it here.
Define it.
The Linux FS, or FX, sorry.
What's that?
Wendell just had posted into the chat session about a Linux distro that looks like Windows 10-ish.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it doesn't have the panes, but I'm looking at it like on the internet, I guess, group Firefox, Google Chrome, Skype, Steam, TeamViewer, Transmission, and Zoom are like already installed in it.
I hate it already.
Microsoft, I can see some logo violations if they don't.
Yeah, I was going to say, I see a lawsuit coming in their future as soon as someone notices.
Yeah.
But it doesn't use Cortana, it uses Google Assist.
The problem is the fact that they're leveraging the Windows logos and stuff. It's a trademark violation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it seems like a straightforward trademark violation.
Yeah, I was going to say that you should take a lawyer about 30 seconds to write up the cease and desist letter.
Yeah, really.
And then my bet would be that they're using Wine to run like Photoshop and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm. You know, I've never had much luck running stuff under Wine. I wind up whining a lot.
It's been hit or miss for me. It really depends on what you're trying to run. If it's like Microsoft Word 2003 was the last Word that actually worked well.
Well, that's the reason you switched to LibreOffice.
Well, yeah. Yes, but there are some times that you have to run Outlook and stuff like that to get corporate mail. And although the web client has gotten so much better here in the past couple of years.
All you do is pay your $30 a month for Office 365.
Yeah. Well, sure, or your employer pays it.
Security problem on your system?
Office 365?
Well, anything with Outlook is a security violation right there.
I don't disagree. But
could it just be not so slow, please? The Outlook client, it's awful.
Well, and also Microsoft's had a huge problem of actually staying up here the last little bit.
Oh, really?
They've had a huge reliability issue. They're about down to 360.
Yeah, it's sad, but if you don't care about what you're doing, then you deserve what you get.
Yeah, then again, I suppose you could make comments about Zoom's security profile and the involvement with the Chinese as well, but...
Well, I keep hearing that somebody in the U.S. has bought it. Now, is that true or just...
You're thinking of TikTok.
Okay.
So TikTok was a social media application that our president demanded be sold to a U.S. company.
Yeah.
Due to its pervasive security, national security issues.
Almost all of that stuff is one monstrous security issue.
This one was worse than most.
Really?
In what it was listening for and what it was being installed and stuff like that. Supposedly, last I heard, someone can correct me if I'm wrong, it was Walmart and Oracle were looking at buying it there for a while. Microsoft took a look at it and that sort of fell through.
Well, if they had to do any development work or change anything, then Microsoft's probably not interested.
Well, there was also a lot of question on just exactly what were they buying.
I bet.
The right to host it on U.S. servers, I think.
Pretty much.
You know, that's always a problem. You get something like that. But isn't Zoom transmitting everything back to the CCP?
So it depends on you have, as the host, you have some control over which data centers you operate out of. Right now, if you click up on the information button up near the recording, it's reporting that we're connected through the United States only.
I wonder if I believe that.
Now, the big issue comes that the mother company back in China still can persuade them to be more forthcoming in their what they give them.
Yeah. Well, that's always an issue, you know. This get pretty scary relationship with China. So, we can't make shoes. I'm not sure we actually can make ball bearings. And that was one of the big targets for. In World War II was bombing German ball bearing factories, because if they kill off the ball bearing factories, everything that requires a ball bearing grinds to a halt. Now, they're better today, so they wouldn't go bad as quick, but, you know.
This entire year has sort of exposed our supply chain concerns.
Yeah.
But even now, there's all sorts of supply chain heartburn.
Oh, yeah.
Little stuff like toilet paper.
I think that's actually still made here.
It is. One of the biggest problems is what kind of toilet paper and the balance between commercial and home toilet paper.
Yeah.
Because with more people being at home, they're using more of the home toilet paper and less of the commercial John Wayne rough, tough, it won't take from anybody toilet paper.
That's funny. But yeah, I mean, things like that, you know, and the globalists in both parties have been pumping that for years.
Yeah. Well, there's things like...
I think that's why Romney's so pissed at Trump, because Trump doesn't seem to have jumped on the bandwagon.
Well, none of the tires are made in the U.S. All the tires are made in Japan. Goodrich, you name it. It's just a brand that they... The manufacturing is all done in China. I mean, Japan, not China.
Goodrich, BFG has been owned by Michelin for at least 25 years, and some of the BFGs are actually made in France. If you look on the side of the tire, it'll actually tell you where it's made. The DOT requires a lot of information on the side of the tires. It's all in a code that you can't read, but if you go on the web, you can find out how to read it in literally seconds. You know, they got the manufacture date, who made it, what country, all kinds of crap like that.
So speaking of resiliency and supply chains and stuff like that, the ACM had a rather interesting talk, Lessons from COVID-19, Efficiency versus Resilience. I'm going to post the link of it here into the Zoom. And you don't have to actually be a member of the ACM to listen to it. They just want you to subscribe or to put in your contact information ahead of time. And it was a presentation from a professor from Rice University and the senior editor of the communications of the ACM, Amash Vardy, which aside from the fact that the guy has the most epic mustache ever, he was pretty interesting.
Oh, yeah, I see his picture here.
I see they have a few more lessons that I need to watch here. That's the problem. All this time inside and nothing to do.
Yeah, really. I live on a, I'm not a farmer, but I live on a farm, which means I get to spend a lot of time outside, whether I want to or not.
See, I just spend my free time making my desktop look pretty. I swear it's useful.
Yeah, I'm out here in the, I guess for Des Moines, you can call them suburbs. You can get to downtown in about 20 minutes tops, but.
Yeah. I used to live in Annapolis, Maryland. You could get from one side of the town to the other in about 9 minutes, except Friday night when
for some reason
evacuating to the shore. Then you just couldn't go that way.
We have about a rush 15, 20 minutes, maybe. Or at least did before everything got weird. Although, for the most part, Iowa is still, even when things were shut down the most that they were, everyone was essential, therefore there was no shutdown.
Yeah, that's the way it kind of was around here. The only people that really got shut down were some restaurants and probably clothing stores. I don't think anybody else actually got shut down. Because I live about 50 miles west of St. Louis, and honestly, it's been so minimal effect out here, you know. I think some of the department stores, I guess you'd call them, I think they got shut down for a while, but they're back.
Yeah, there were a few places that were shut down for just a little bit, but and then restaurants had restrictions and bars were shut for a while, but even though I didn't do any traveling just because I'm a developer, I can work from home on a good day, let alone on a bad day. They actually gave us a your essential letter just in case you had to drive into the office.
Yeah. Well, we made two trips to Wyoming, one to Salt Lake and one to Wyoming. With my daughter earlier this year in, I guess it was April.